ankles, bumping two other girls down. She leaned closer to Katie's ear.
Pat Clayman's copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Katie stared at her, fork in midair, her dark-lashed, sultry eyes wide. Pat Clayman's brother had smuggled her the book on family visit day 2 months ago, and it had been passed from girl to girl ever since. Every girl at Idlewild was crazy to get her hands on it.
"You're kidding," Katie said. "How did you do it?"
"It wasn't easy. I had to give Pat $10. Katie's eyes went even whiter.
$10? Cece, where did you get that?
Cece shrugged. "My father sends me money, you know. It was either that or read Sandra Creckley's stack of Life magazines, but those are all 2 years old." Today's dinner was beef, mashed potatoes, creamed corn, and a sticky sweetbread that Cece thought was supposed to be cornbread, but tasted like nothing at all. Katie picked up a scoop of potatoes on her fork and put it in her mouth, her expression thoughtful. Cece watched as Katie's gaze roamed the room, her eyes narrowing and calculating. She always saw things going on around them that Cece was too stupid to see.
"You'll have to read us the good parts aloud," Katie said.
"I can't," Cece blushed. "No way. When I get to the racy bits, I'll give the book to you."
"Fine, I'll read it."
Katie tossed her hair and poked at her potatoes again. "It's probably nothing I haven't seen anyway." This was Katie's usual line. She came across like she was experienced with men, but Cece was starting to notice that she never gave any details. She didn't care.
"I hear it's juicy," she said, trying to keep Katie strung along.
"Pat says there are even bad words in it, and they do things." But Katie's attention was drifting. In the back corner, Allison Garner and Sherry Koustapos were arguing at their table, their heads lowered. Sherry had an angry snarl on her lip. Katie watched them warily. She seemed to have a radar for trouble, as if she could detect it from any quarter. Cece tried to distract her.
"Hey, there's Roberta."
Roberta was crossing the room, carrying her wooden tray with her dinner on it. She sat at a table with her field hockey team, the girls jostling and giggling, while Roberta was quiet. Cece looked down at her plate and realized she'd already eaten everything on it, so she put down her knife and fork.
"Do you ever wonder," Katie said, "why Roberta is here? Her grades are good, and she's an athlete. She doesn't seem to belong."
"Oh, that's easy," Cece said without thinking. "Her uncle came home from the war and tried to kill himself. Roberta walked in on him doing it, so they sent her away."
"What?"
Katie stared at Cece, and Cece realized she'd scored an even bigger point than she had with Lady Chatterley's lover.
"How do you know that?"
"Susan Brady isn't just the dorm monitor, you know," Cece told her. "She knows everything. She heard Miss Maxwell telling Mrs. Peabody about it, and then she told me." Katie seemed to process this.
"That doesn't make any sense. If the uncle is crazy, why was Roberta the one who was sent away?"
"Maybe she saw blood," Cece said. "Maybe she had a nervous breakdown or something. If I saw something like that, I'd want to get as far away as possible." It was a fair point. They looked at Roberta, who was eating her dinner in silence, her face pale.
"Keep your head down," Katie warned after a minute. "Here comes Lady Loon."
The argument at the back table had escalated, and Sherry Koustapos had jumped up, shoving the bench with the backs of her knees. Allison was still sitting, eating her creamed corn, but her face was red with silent fury. Cece had felt Allison's wrath only once, in her first month at Idlewild. Allison had called her a fat cow and hit her with one of the broken badminton rackets from the locker storage room, and she never wanted to feel it again. Allison hated everyone, and when she hit hard. Striding across the room, heading for the commotion, was Miss London, the teacher everyone knew as Lady Loon. Her dirty blonde hair was frizzing loose from its top knot, and the armpits of her flowered polyester dress were damp. She was in her 20s, Idlewild's youngest teacher, and after only 6 months of teaching here, she was still woefully unprepared. The girls' moods drove her crazy, their dramas riled her up, and their lack of discipline always enraged her. With over 100 teenage girls, most of them unsalvageable, riding her nerves every day, she spent most of her time in a crazy rage that would have been funny if it didn't have an echo of hopelessness about it. "Ladies!" Cece heard her say over the din of the fighting rabble of girls. "Ladies, sit down!" The girls didn't notice. With a gasp, Cece watched Sherry lean over and spit on Allison's plate. Allison barely paused before she jumped off her bench and hit as hard as she could, her heavy, waxy fist making contact with Sherry's nose with an audible crack. The other teachers, who had stood milling at the edge of the room, reluctantly began to move, muttering. Lady Loon, it was her habit of calling the girls ladies that gave her the title, wrenched Allison by the arm and dragged her from the table. The din was deafening. Girls were shouting, Sherry was screaming and bleeding, and the teachers were moving in as a group. Cece couldn't hear her voice, but she could see Lady Loon's lipsticked mouth forming the words, "Calm down, ladies! Calm down!" She watched as blood dripped between Sherry's fingers and spattered on the floor, and she inched a little closer to Katie. "I hate blood," she said. She followed Katie's gaze, which had left the melee and focused on something else. Sonia was standing in front of one of the large windows, behind a knot of excited girls. The French girl was still, her face pale. How had Cece never noticed how small she was? Sonia always seemed so strong, like a blade, narrow but impossible to break. Yet she was shorter than all the American girls around her, and when one of them bumped past her to get a better view, Sonia was knocked almost off balance, like a rag doll. But it was her face that made Cece sit up in alarm. Sonia's expression was empty, as blank as a piece of notepaper, her lips slack. Her usual look of quick, quiet intelligence, as if she was thinking fascinating things without saying them, had vanished. Her hands dangled at her sides. Her eyes, which were normally observant and a little wry, were open and seeing. They must have been seeing, but they contained nothing at all. Lady Loon was restraining Allison, who was kicking and screaming now. Sherry had sagged to her knees, and one of her friends had fainted. The teachers had descended on the group, tugging at Sherry, trying to clear space around the fainted girl. Mrs. Peabody held Allison's other arm, and Cece could hear her booming voice. "It's special detention for you, my girl, do you hear? Get moving! Move!" Cece looked back at Sonia. She was watching, watching. Her skin had gone gray. From the other corner of the room, Cece saw Roberta get up from her table and try to make her way across the room toward Sonia, her face tight with fear. "Katie," Cece said over the noise, "is Sonia sick?" Katie touched Cece's wrist. "Quick!" She rose from her chair, and Cece followed, the two of them winding their way through the sweaty, excited crowd of girls toward Sonia. Roberta was coming from the other direction, but her progress was slower, impeded by a thick section of her hockey friends. Katie dodged expertly through the crowd of wool uniforms, using her elbows and her knees. Cece followed in her wake, thinking of the color of Sonia's face. "There's something wrong with Sonia," she thought. "How did we not know? How did we not see that there's something wrong with Sonia?" Sonia was still by the window, unmoving. Katie swooped past her, took her hand, and tugged it. Without thinking, Cece took Sonia's other hand, so the girl was protected from both sides. When Cece was a girl, her rich father had sent her a Christmas present at her first boarding school, a baby doll. The baby had unsettling marble eyes, a hard skull, and two hard hands, molded into tiny fingers that formed into an impossibly adult shape. Sonia's hand reminded Cece of one of those hands now. Small, cold, folded in on itself, alive,
but somehow dead.
Cece kept hold of it as she and Katie maneuvered the French girl out of the room. From the corner of her eye, she saw Roberta following, her long legs eating the ground to catch up to them easily, her braid swinging, her forehead stamped with worry. Sonia made no sound, no protest. Her feet stumbled between Katie and Cece, but her hands and arms did not move. They left the dining hall and came out into the wet air, the four of them moving as one toward Clayton Hall.
"It's all right," she heard herself say to Sonia, even though she didn't know what was wrong. "It's all right."
"Should we get her to the infirmary?" Roberta asked. The infirmary was across the common, in the teacher's hall.
"No."
Katie's voice was flat. "We're not taking her to Nurse Hedmeyer. She can't help anyway. Just get her to the dorm. Keep walking."
"We should tell someone," Cece said.
"Tell who?" Katie turned to her as they walked, and her eyes were so angry that Cece felt herself pale in shock. "Lady Loon? Mrs. Peabody? About this? They'll just discipline her. Have you lost your mind?"
"Shut up, Katie," Roberta said. "She's trying to help."
Cece looked at Sonia's ashen face, her half-closed eyes. There was something going on she didn't understand. She was always so stupid, so stupid.
"What's wrong with her?"
No one answered. They entered Clayton Hall, and they helped Sonia up the stairs to the third floor. Sonia tried to walk between them, but her ankles buckled and her head sagged. She said something in French that sounded like a recitation, the words spilling automatically as her lips moved. None of the other girls knew French, but Cece watched Sonia's lips as the four of them hit the third floor landing.
"I think she's praying."
"She isn't praying," Katie said. In their room, they put Sonia to bed in her bunk, laying her on top of the covers and pulling off her shoes. Sonia muttered again, and this time there were English words mixed in with the French. Cece put her ear to Sonia's lips and caught some words.
"Please don't take me there. Please don't. I'll be quiet."
She was repeating it under her breath. Finally, the girl rolled over on her back and put her shaking hands to her face, shutting them out, her thin legs sticking out from beneath her rucked-up skirt. Roberta sat on the edge of the bed. Katie stood, looking down at Sonia with an impenetrably dark expression on her face, and then she said, "I'll get a glass of water," and left the room. Cece looked at Roberta, her long, plainly pretty face, her blonde hair tied back. Roberta's expression when she looked at Sonia was troubled, but deep with understanding. She didn't think anyone wanted her to talk, but she couldn't help herself.
"How did you know what was happening?" she asked. "How did you know what to do?"
Roberta shook her head. "I didn't."
"You've seen her do something like this before, haven't you?"
The pause before Roberta spoke was a beat too long.
"No."
Roberta's expression slowly closed down, the emotion leaving it. She became as impassive as a statue. Maybe it was Roberta who had had a fit like this after her uncle tried to kill himself. Maybe, beneath her quiet demeanor, Roberta wasn't as calm and confident as she seemed.
"What does it mean?" Cece asked her. "Is she sick?"
Cece, shut up.
But she couldn't.
When Cece was afraid, when she was nervous, she found it hard to shut up.
"Katie knew, too. She's seen this before."
"No, I haven't." Katie was in the doorway, a glass of water in her hand. "I just think on my feet. She's had a shock of some kind, and she was about to faint. We had to get her out of there so the teachers wouldn't see. Sonia, drink this." She reached down, pulled one of the other girl's hands from her face, tilted her head back, and looked into her eyes.
"Listen to me," she said clearly.
"People saw us leaving. It's over if you don't get hold of yourself. Girls who faint get sent to special detention for being disruptive. Now sit up." Cece opened her mouth to protest, but to her amazement, Sonia swung her legs over the side of the bed and sat up.
She swayed for a second, then held out her hand.
"Give me the water," she said,
her voice a rasp, her French accent sharpened by exhaustion. A knock came on the door.
"Ladies?"
It was Lady Loon.
"What is going on in there?"
Katie nodded to Roberta, and Roberta stood and opened the door.
"Nothing, Miss London," she said. "Sonia had a fit of dizziness, but she's well now."
Sonia had been gulping the water, but she lowered the glass and looked at the teacher.
"I hate blood," she said clearly.
Lady Loon ran a hand through her disastrous hair.
"Afternoon class starts in 20 minutes," she said. "Anyone not in attendance will be noted for detention. Is that clear?"
"Yes, Miss London," Cece said.
The teacher looked helplessly up the hallway, then down again, then wandered off toward the stairwell. Cece looked at the faces of the other three girls. What had happened in the dining hall had nearly given Sonia a nervous breakdown. What could be so horrible that it could be brought back by the sight of two girls fighting? She usually felt like the stupid one, but she thought maybe she was starting to see. She didn't know everything about her friends, but these were Idlewild girls. Idlewild girls were always here for a reason. They were rough like Katie or impassive like Roberta because something had made them that way, something they instinctively understood in one another. They hadn't known what exactly was wrong with Sonia. They still didn't know, but they had recognized it all the same.
"Please don't take me there," Sonia had said.
Cece didn't know what it meant, but it was something terrible, maybe more terrible than anything the rest of them had seen. Cece hadn't been wanted, not by either her father or her mother, but she'd always been safe. She'd never been in the kind of danger that she thought Sonia was seeing behind her eyes. She'd never had anything really bad happen to her. Not really bad. Except for the water. That day at the beach with her mother years ago, swimming in the ocean, looking up through the water, unable to breathe, and seeing her mother's face. Then nothing. But the water had been a long time ago, and it had been an accident. And as Cece's mother had told her, girls had accidents all the time.
Chapter 7. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. It was a 20-minute walk over the hardened, muddy ground to the well. Fiona walked behind Anthony Eden, glancing at his black-clad back as he scrambled in his expensive shoes. She kept her hand on her camera so it wouldn't bounce against her chest, and she was grateful she'd remembered to wear her hiking boots. She had simply followed him from the dining hall after he got the call, without a word, and so far he was so flustered he hadn't yet thought to send her away. Through the gaps in the trees, she glimpsed the sports field where Deb had been found. There was nothing there now but empty, overgrown grass. Closer were the indoor gymnasium and girls' lockers, the building dilapidated and falling down. In the eaves of the overhang at the edge of the building, she could see tangles of generations of birds' nests. The workmen were gathered in a knot. One of them had pulled out a large plastic tarp of cheerful, incongruous blue and was attempting to unfold it. The others watched Anthony as their foreman stepped forward.
"Are you certain?" Anthony said. The man's face was gray.
"Yes, sir," he said. "It's pretty clear."
"It isn't a hoax. Teenagers have been using this property to scare each other for years."
The foreman shook his head.
"Not a hoax. I've been in this business 20 years, and I've never seen anything like it."
Anthony's lips pursed. "Let me see." They led him around the rise. There was a digger of some kind and a backhoe, both of them parked and silent. Dug into the slope of the rise was a huge, ragged hole, the edges of mud and crumbling brick. Though it was full daylight, the center of the hole was pitch black, as if it led into the depths of somewhere light could not go.
"In there," the foreman said.
There was a smell, wet, rancid.
digging into the back of the brain, traveling down the spine. Anthony took a large flashlight from one of the workmen and approached the hole, carefully climbing over the mud and the broken bricks in his leather shoes. Swallowing the smell, Fiona followed at his shoulder. He clicked on the flashlight and shone it into the blackness.
I don't see anything.
Lower, sir. You'll see it.
The foreman paused.
You'll see her.
Her. Fiona stared at the circle of light, watching it move down the well. The far wall was still intact, the bricks damp and slimy. Her hands were cold, but she couldn't put them in her pockets. She couldn't move as the light traveled down, down. And then, her. She was not a hoax. The girl was folded, her knees bent, tucked beneath her chin. Her head was down, her face hidden, as if bowed with grief. Rotten strands of long hair trailed down her back. One hand was dropped to her side, hidden in the darkness. The other was curled over one shin, nothing but a translucent sheen of long-gone skin over dark bone. The shin itself was a mottled skeleton. Her shoes, which had probably been leather, had long rotted away, leaving only rubber soles beneath the ruins of her feet. But there were ragged remains of the rest of her clothes, a thin wool coat, mostly decayed away, a collar around her neck that was the last of what had once been a blouse with a Peter Pan collar, a skirt discolored with mold, threads dangling from her skeletal legs that had once been wool stockings.
There's no water in the well.
This was the foreman's voice, low and strangled.
It dried up, which was why it wasn't in use anymore. The water, it drained away down.
He trailed off, and Fiona wondered if he was pointing or gesturing somewhere. Neither she nor Anthony was watching.
So it's damp in there, sure, but she's just been sitting there.
Fiona swallowed and said to Anthony, "Give me the flashlight." He seemed to have shut down. He handed the light to her immediately. She hefted it, swung it down to the girl's skirt. "The color is bleached away," she said. "Idlewild uniforms were navy blue and dark green." Her research last night had drawn up more than one class picture, girls lined up in rows, wearing identical skirts and blouses. "I can't tell if she's got the Idlewild crest."
"She's a student," Anthony said.
His voice was low, his words mechanical, as if he was not thinking of what he was saying.
"She must be. Look at her."
"She's small," Fiona said, traveling the light over the body again. "She looks like a child."
"Not a child."
His voice was almost a whisper.
"Not a child. A girl. This is a disaster. This will end us. The entire project. Everything."
He turned and looked at her, as if remembering she was there.
"Oh, God, you're a journalist. Are you going to write about this? What are you going to do?"
Fiona tore her gaze from the body in the well and stared at him. Something was crawling through her at the sight of the body, crawling over her skin. Not just revulsion and pity, something big, something that had to do with Deb and the words scrawled on the window, "Good night, girl." "I don't know," she said. "Maybe she fell, but it's part of the story." She watched his jaw clamp shut, his mind work. He was thinking about lawyers, nondisclosure agreements, gag orders. None of it mattered. Fiona was already standing here, looking at the body, and the cat was already out of the bag.
"You can't possibly be such a jackal," he said finally.
"I'm not sure what I am," she told him. "But I'm not a jackal. I'm a writer. And this," she motioned to the gaping hole in the well, the girl inside, "can be handled with respect." She thought of Deb, the news stories from 20 years ago. "I can do it. I might be the only one who can do it right." He was silent for a long minute.
"You can't promise that. The police."
"I can help with that, too." She pulled out her cell phone and dialed. "Listen." It rang only twice before Jamie's voice came on the other end.
"Fee?" Jamie, I'm at Idlewild. We're going to need some police.
He paused, surprised. She'd called his personal cell phone.
What are you talking about? What's going on?
They've found a body here.
Shit. Shit, Fee. Call 911.
Fiona remembered that she'd used the wrong terminology in this case. It isn't a fresh body. It's remains. Definitely human. Probably decades old. We'll need a coroner, some police. But can it be quiet? It might be an accident. She might have just fallen.
She?
Yes. The owners want it quiet until she's identified and it's sorted out. Can that be done? He paused for a second.
All right,
he said.
I'll take care of it. We're on our way. Your help is admirable, Anthony said as she hung up, but futile.
Don't be so sure. He put his icy hand over hers on the flashlight and aimed it at the back of the dead girl's head.
Look at that, he said. Now tell me she fell.
Fiona stared. Who are you? She thought. What happened? Who are you, and how did you get here? Even after so many years, with the blood long gone, it was clear in the light. Beneath the strands of hair, the back of the girl's head was smashed, a section of the skull, nothing but shards of broken bone. The day stretched long over the cold light of afternoon and the early descent of evening. By 6 o'clock, the crew on scene had set up lights beneath the two tents they worked in, one over the ruins of the well, the second to receive and photograph the body. The crew was small. Fiona had memories of crowds of people in the news footage after Deb's body was found. Uniformed cops pressing back rubberneckers, detectives and crime scene techs scurrying in and out, more uniformed cops spreading out to look for footprints. But this was different. There was a handful of people moving back and forth between the tents, talking as quietly as if they were working in a library. There were no rubberneckers, except Fiona, who was sitting on a pile of broken stone from the well, sipping a hot cup of coffee. Anthony Eden was gone, probably to report to his mother, and the only uniform on the scene belonged to Jamie. He exited the tent with the body in it and crossed the grass to sit next to her, wearing his heavy cop's parka. His hair looked darker in the onset of dusk, his trim beard of lighter gold.
"We're almost done," he said.
Fiona nodded and made room for him to sit next to her. "Thanks for the coffee."
"It's nothing. You've been sitting here all day. You must be freezing."
"I'm fine." Her toes were a little frigid in her hiking boots, and her ass was numb, but it wasn't anything she couldn't handle. She'd long ago put her camera back in her car, since pictures were out of the question. "Can you tell me anything?" He stared at the lit tent and seemed to think it over.
"Is this off the record?"
"Jamie, for God's sake."
"I know. I have to ask. It's my job."
She drew a thumbnail along the top of her coffee cup. "Fine. It's off the record."
"She was a teenager,"
he said, appeased.
14, 15, thereabouts. Small for her age, but based on the bones, Dave Saunders is certain."
"The cause of death?"
"It's preliminary until the autopsy is done, but you saw her head. Saunders says a blow with something big and blunt, a rock or the end of a shovel."
"She couldn't have hit her head on the way down the well?"
"No. The bricks in the well are the wrong shape, the wrong size, too smooth."
She'd been expecting it, but still she felt something heavy in her stomach. Her glance wandered off through the trees toward the sports field where Deb had lain. Two girls dead, 400 feet apart. "How old is the body?"
"Based on the decomposition, at least 40 years. According to Saunders, she's reasonably well preserved because she's been in the well, though not in water. The body is too old to test whether she was raped. No animals have been at her, and she's been mostly protected from the elements, but she's decomposed. She's been there a long time."
This girl had been here, long dead, curled inside the well, on the night Deb was murdered.
and after Deb was dead and before her body was found on the field, Idlewild had been the resting site for two murdered girls, decades apart. There was no way Fiona could be impartial about this, no way she could avoid crossing the lines. I've seen pictures of the Idlewild uniforms, and they were navy blue and green. She isn't wearing a uniform, is she? Jamie said nothing, and Fiona turned and looked at him. He was still staring at the tent where the body lay, his jaw set. What? Fiona said. You know something else. What is it? He paused.
We can't be sure. And if I tell you, you have to stay out of it at least until we notify the family.
Fiona felt the hair on the back of her neck stand up. You've identified her?
There's a tag sewn into the collar of her blouse, he said. A name tag.
Tell me.
Fee, you've been on the other side of this. If she has family and the slightest thing is handled wrong, we make this worse.
Fiona knew. She remembered the day the cops had knocked on their door, the minute she had seen their faces and known that Deb wasn't missing anymore. She pulled a notebook and pen from her back jeans pocket. Just tell me.
I'm warning you, don't go digging. Give us a few days at least. This is a police investigation.
I know. Fiona stared at him, waiting.
I know.
Jamie, tell me. He scrubbed a hand over his face.
Sonia Gallipo, he said. I don't recognize the name. I don't think it's a local family. She may have been a student from away. It doesn't ring a bell for me, any missing girl with that name. But I already have Harvey digging into the files back at the station. He'll call me any minute. And we don't even have confirmation that this girl is Sonia Gallipo. She could just be wearing Sonia's blouse. She could have stolen or borrowed it, or bought it secondhand.
Fiona scribbled down the name in her notebook. I'll do my own search, she said, holding up a hand before he could speak. Just on the internet, no phone calls. And I'll ask Dad. Jamie's mouth was open to speak, but he thought better of it and closed it. He might not like it, but he was smart enough not to turn down help from Malcolm if it could aid the case.
I want to know what he says and what you find.
I'll come by later. She pocketed the notebook and pen, then flung an arm around his neck, leaning in close to his ear, feeling the tension in his shoulders even through his parka. I'll bring takeout, and we'll trade. Quid pro quo. How does that sound? He still stared ahead, but a red flush moved up his cheeks.
You do this to me, he said, shaking his head. Fuck it. Bring beer.
I will. She could have kissed him, but she didn't. Instead, she got up and headed back over the muddy track toward her car, without looking back to see if he was watching.
Chapter 8. Sonia. Barrons, Vermont, October 1950. Books were her salvation. As a child, she'd had a shelf of childhood favorites that she loved enough to read over and over again. But after, during the hospital stay and the long voyage and the cold days in Idlewild's dreary hallways, books became more than mere stories. They were her lifeline. The pages as essential to her as breathing. Even now, sitting in class, Sonia touched her finger to the yellowed pages of her Latin textbook, as if its texture could calm her. At the blackboard, Mrs. Peabody droned on about verb conjugation as the 10 girls in the room fidgeted in their chairs. Charlotte Cankle peeled at a hangnail on her thumb, watching from under her angry, lowered brows as a bead of blood came out. Cindy Benshaw shifted in her chair and scratched her ear, the motion of her arm revealing the circles of sweat stains on the armpit of her blouse, like the rings of an old tree. It was cold outside, but it was suffocating in here, the room airless, the smells of unwashed girls' bodies and chalk dust trapped in a bubble. Sonia already knew this Latin lesson. She had read ahead in the textbook ages ago. She couldn't help it. Books were in short supply at Idlewild. There was no library, no literature class, no kindly librarian to take My Friend Flicka from the shelf and hand it over with a smile.
The only books at Idlewild were sent by friends or family, dropped off on rare family visit days, or brought back by the lucky girls after Christmas holiday visits home. As a result, every book in Idlewild, no matter how silly or dull, circulated through 100 hungry hands before finally disintegrating into individual pages, which were often held together by an elastic band until the pages themselves began to disappear. And when there were no other books to be had, the most desperate girls read textbooks. Barely listening to the lecture, Sonia flipped the pages of the textbook over, looking for the handwriting, pencil writing, just as Katie had shown them in her own book under the light of a flashlight. She turned to the first page of the textbook's index and stared at the writing in the margin. "Mary hates the teachers more than she hates us. Jessie Dunn, January 1947. Sonia turned away from the page again and looked up at Mrs. Peabody. She was writing on the blackboard, her wide rear end on full display, her thick waist pinched painfully by her ill-fitting girdle beneath her polyester dress. Idlewild's polite fiction that its girls would leave educated, ready for great things, Bryn Mawr, Yale, Harvard, was one that no one believed, not even the teachers. Her temples pounded, an after-effect of yesterday's episode in the dining hall. The details were shaky and juddery in places, like a film coming off its reel. She had frozen at supper, watching the girls fight, listening to the angry shouts from the teachers. Her friends had taken her back to their room while she'd fought the memory of something awful and terrifying, a thing she didn't want to look at or touch anymore. Charlotte Kankel was sucking the side of her thumb, licking the blood off. She watched Mrs. Peabody with a sort of hypnotized focus, a half-asleep concentration. Sonia envied her, the way she could turn her brain off, think about absolutely nothing. It was a trick Sonia herself had never learned. That was what books did. They turned off your thinking for you, put their thoughts in your head, so you wouldn't have your own. Her own treasure was her copy of Blackie's Girl's Annual, found on a shelf in the dorm, left by some previous occupant and quickly squirreled away so she could stare at its 30-year-old plates and read its strange stories of English schoolgirls' picnic outings over and over again. Books, Sonia had decided, were what she would live with when she finally left this place. She would work in a library, anywhere. She'd sweep the floors if she had to, but she'd work in a library, and she'd read the books every day for the rest of her life. Sonia's chair jerked, Katie kicking her from the desk behind. Sonia had never seen a girl who got bored as fast or as dangerously as Katie. Roberta had the ability to be still, and Cece rarely got bored at all, but behind Katie's tilted, dark-lashed eyes lurked a restless intelligence that sometimes looked for trouble. Sure enough, seconds later, a scrap of paper sailed over Sonia's shoulder and landed on her desk. Sonia uncrumpled it to see a crude drawing of Mrs. Peabody wearing a witch's hat, sporting a wart on her nose, riding a field hockey stick, her black skirt hiked up and a pelt of dark hair visible on her knobby legs. The caption beneath the drawing read, "Sportsmanship, girls! Sportsmanship!" Sonia stifled a laugh. Sportsmanship was Mrs. Peabody's hobby horse. The lecture she gave out regularly, whether the topic was test marks or proper ways to line up in the dining hall or actual sports, lack of sportsmanship, in Mrs. Peabody's view, was the root of most problems with Idlewild girls. Like Lady Loon's constant use of ladies or Mrs. Wentworth's spitting as she spoke, it was a tick that became more noticeable with the suffocating familiarity that was life at a boarding school, and it made for good satire. The sportsmanship lecture was unavoidable for any student who spent years in Mrs. Peabody's class. Sonia slipped the paper into her textbook just as Mrs. Peabody turned around. "Miss Winthrop?" the teacher said with dark intent. "Yes, Mrs. Peabody?" came Katie's voice from behind Sonia. "You are disturbing my class for the third time this week."
Though she wasn't facing her, Sonia could imagine Katie's lip curling.
I didn't do anything.
Mrs. Peabody's eyes went hard. She was a 50-ish woman with a face pockmarked with old acne scars. She handled the girls with more dignity than Lady Loon, but she was tough as nails and usually mean, her fingers and teeth yellowed with nicotine. Sonia wondered what had caused Mrs. Peabody, like the other teachers, to take a job at Idlewild instead of at a normal school.
"Your rudeness is only making it worse for you," she said to Katie.
"I didn't do anything, you old hag," Katie snapped back.
Sonia felt clammy sweat on her back, beneath her blouse. Charlotte Kankle had stopped sucking her thumb, and Cindy Benshaw was staring, open-mouthed.
"Stop shouting," Sonia thought.
She remembered having the same thought in the dining hall yesterday.
"Katie Winthrop!"
Mrs. Peabody picked up a ruler and smacked it hard on the desk, making all the girls jump.
"You are the most disobedient!"
Next to the blackboard, the classroom door flew open and hit the wall with a bang. The girls jumped again, including Sonia. The sound was as loud as a gunshot, the doorknob crashing into the wall. There was no one in the doorway. Nothing to see beyond it but an empty hall.
"Let me in," a voice said.
Mrs. Peabody dropped her ruler. There was a breath of silence in the room, a waft of cold air down the back of Sonia's neck. She slid down in her chair, her body wanting to fold in on itself.
What was that?
Sonia looked around. Rose Perry had her hand over her mouth, her eyes wide. Charlotte Kankle was gripping the sides of her desk with a white-knuckled hold. Had everyone heard it, or was it just her?
"What is this?"
Mrs. Peabody nearly shouted, her voice harsh and shrill.
Fear, Sonia realized.
She recognized fear. It was crawling through the depths of her own stomach right now.
"Is this some kind of prank?"
The teacher stared at them, her eyes blazing. The room was silent. Even Katie didn't speak. Someone giggled, the sound terrified and completely devoid of humor. Someone else whispered, "Shh." Sonia stared at the open square of doorway.
What if something is coming? Right now. Down the hallway toward the door, slow and steady, closer. When it reaches the door, it will...
"Fine,"
Mrs. Peabody said into the silence of the room.
"Since no one will confess, Miss Winthrop, get up. You're going to detention."
"That's unfair," Katie shouted. "I didn't do anything."
Mrs. Peabody marched out from behind her desk and up the classroom aisle. Her face was red now, her cheeks mottled.
"Get up," she said. "Right now."
She yanked Katie out of her seat by the arm, jerking her upward in a bruising grip. Katie's limbs jumped like a marionette's, and her face set in an expression hard as granite. As Mrs. Peabody yanked her mercilessly back down the aisle, Katie caught Sonia's eye, and her look was cold. The girls watched as Katie was taken from the room, her shoes clapping uneasily on the old wood floor as she tried to keep her balance in Mrs. Peabody's grip. Then both of them were gone, and the air was heavy with silence. Not one girl breathed a word.
"I should have done something," Sonia thought softly to herself, staring down at her textbook again. "I should have stood up. It's too late now." And suddenly, she felt like crying.
Chapter 9. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. At 10 o'clock that night, Fiona arrived at Jamie's. She brought her laptop, her notebooks, and the promised six-pack of beer. Jamie lived on the top floor of a duplex in downtown Barrons, an old Victorian house that had been restored to a degree and rented. The lady who owned it was more than happy to rent the top unit to a cop, and the family with two small children who lived in the bottom unit were happy to have him for a neighbor. The street was a tree-lined lane that had been wealthy 100 years ago, when Barrons had seen better days. Now its big Victorians were split into apartments for blue-collar parents and retirees, and rusty bikes and abandoned kids' toys littered the half-mowed lawns.
He was sitting at his own laptop at the kitchen table, wearing worn jeans and a gray t-shirt when she came in. There was a single light on overhead, the rest of the apartment in darkness. He didn't look up from the file he was reading when she closed the door behind her.
"You eat?" he said. "There are leftovers in the fridge."
She dropped her things on the table across from him and hesitated. She hadn't eaten. He knew that. She probably should, but her brain was buzzing with everything she'd found, and she wanted to get to it. Jamie looked up at her as if reading her mind.
"Eat, or this doesn't get done," he said.
She sighed. "Fine." He waved her away and went back to his file. She knew exactly how he felt. She dug in the fridge and found pasta and meat sauce, cold. She dumped some into a bowl, added a spoon, pulled two beers from the six-pack, and walked back to the table.
"Who's first?"
she asked, sitting down and sliding his beer over to him.
"I'll go."
Jamie cracked his beer and took a drink.
"Sonia Galipo, age 15, was reported missing in early December 1950. She was an Idlewild student with no local family. She left to visit a great-aunt and great-uncle in Burlington. She left after a day without their permission, ran away. She got on the bus back to Barron's. She never got there, and she was never seen again."
"So it is her," Fiona said, "not just a borrowed blouse."
"It seems so, yes."
Jamie riffled through his stack of papers.
"We have no trace of dental records and no trace of any living relatives. The great-aunt and great-uncle are long dead, no descendants. So at this point we can't match her, even with DNA.
Fiona took a bite of her cold pasta. "Where was she last seen?"
"Burlington, getting on the bus, by the ticket taker."
"What did the bus driver say?"
"No one interviewed him. No one even found out his name."
Jamie pulled an old folder out of his pile and held it up.
"You see this? This is the missing persons file."
It had two or three pieces of paper in it, tops.
"She was a boarding school girl, and she was 15, so she was presumed a runaway. Case closed."
"Who reported her missing?"
"The headmistress at Idlewild, one Julia Patton."
Jamie put the file down again.
"She died in 1971, so that's a dead end. I can't get a line on Idlewild student records because the school has been closed for so long, and Anthony Eden won't return my calls."
"Aha." Fiona held up her spoon. "That's where I come in. He returned mine." Jamie shook his head.
"Of course he did."
"It pays to have a nosy journalist on your side," Fiona said. "But in this case, it's a dead end. Because get this, according to Anthony Eden, there are no Idlewild student records." Jamie sat back in his chair.
"They're gone?"
"Disappeared when the school closed and were most likely destroyed. 60 years of records."
"That's going to make things harder."
He scratched at his beard for a second, dismayed.
"Do you think Eden is lying?"
"Maybe," Fiona said. She took another scoop of the pasta. "It's always possible, but I can't see the angle. He wants this squared away fast, not drawn out. I can't picture him carting dozens of moldy old file boxes out of there and hiding them, and I can't figure what he would be covering up, since this happened before he was born."
"Neither can I, but I'm going to run a check at local storage places to see if he's rented a space. That many records would need room."
That was fine with her. She'd promised Anthony to handle the story quietly, not to keep him immune from police probing. "What else did you find?" she asked Jamie.
"We did a basic check on the name," he replied. "She was only 15, so there wasn't much. No medical or dental that we could find. She'd never been in the system before, as either a juvenile delinquent or a runaway. And no birth certificate either. She wasn't born here."
That surprised her. They were a few hours from Quebec, and French names were not that uncommon. "She was from Canada?" Jamie shook his head.
"France."
"Damn. Damn, she should have thought of that angle, instead of assuming and looking locally. Never make assumptions," her father admonished in her head. "You found immigration records?" He nodded, his expression haunted.
"She came in 1947.
It hit her. Arriving from France in 1947, age 12, no family.
Shit, she said. You mean she was a refugee?
Yes.
She put down her spoon and rubbed her fingertips over her eye sockets, thinking. So Sonia spent her childhood in France during the war. Nazi-occupied France. She lost her parents, her family, and she came here only to...
Only to be murdered and dumped in a well.
Jamie finished for her. They were silent for a minute. It had happened over 60 years ago, but something about it was still nauseating, as if she could smell that rotten stench from the blackness of the well once again. She pressed her fingers harder, then dropped her hands. It was done. Sonia Galipo was dead, no matter how unjustly. She couldn't change it, but maybe she could do something about it. What about her records from France? She said to Jamie. Can you get those? He was sitting back in his chair, staring blankly at his laptop screen, as if it might give him answers. He listlessly picked up his beer and drained it.
I've put the request out, he said. It'll take a day or two. The only reason I was given permission to do it at all was in case she had living relatives in Europe that we can inform. Maybe someone, somewhere, was left to look for her.
Fiona stared at him. She knew how a small police force worked. And she knew even more now that she'd spent a year with him. How long do we have? She asked. Jamie shook his head.
Not long. We don't have many detectives, Fee, and there was a murder in Burlington last week. We can spend some resources on it, but this girl has no family, and the likelihood is that whoever did this is dead.
But it's a murder, she protested. Once the coroner confirms it, it's an open case.
A cold one. Cold before we even touched it. We'll do our diligence, we'll investigate, but our resources are limited. There are fresh cases we have to work. If nothing comes up quick, we move on.
Fiona realized she hadn't touched her own beer yet. She cracked it open and took a drink. Can your father help? Jamie's father was a retired chief of police, and he still had cronies in the department who held considerable sway.
I already asked him, Jamie said. He said there's no point.
He held up Sonia's slim missing persons file again.
This is from Granddad's time. He was one of the cops who interviewed the headmistress. Granddad died in 1982. The cop who took down this report is dead, too.
We need people who were young at that time, she said. She opened her laptop and powered it up. They're more likely to be alive now. How tired are you?
I'm not tired, he said.
He looked tired, but she knew that, like her, he'd never sleep. They'd never done this before, she realized, worked together on something. Usually their work took them in separate directions, which was how she'd thought they liked it, but it was good working with Jamie.
What do you have in mind?
He asked. She circled her thoughts back to the task at hand. It'll take some searching, but if we split it up, it won't take as long. She said. She opened her email and called up a message from her inbox. There's almost nothing about Idlewild online, she said. Most boarding schools have alumni associations or something, but Idlewild was different. When it shut down, it just disappeared.
Not the usual kind of student bonding, Jamie said.
It wasn't a happy place for most of those girls, I think. They were sent there because they were problem kids. As far as I can tell, no one has ever planned a reunion, or tried to. Facebook gave me nothing either, so I called the local historical society. The Barron's Historical Society, it turned out, consisted of two old widowed sisters who kept copies of newspapers and random other papers willed to the society in a rented office that was open for only 4 hours a week. They might have seemed like dotty eccentrics on the surface, but Hester, the sister Fiona had talked to, had knowledge of Barron's that rivaled Jamie's.
I've never been there, Jamie said.
You'd probably love it, Fiona told him. However, they had next to nothing about Idlewild Hall, only a few class photographs. I had the woman I talked to scan and email them to me. Fiona had been prepared to drive to the office and do that herself instead of asking an elderly woman to do it, but Hester had surprised her, saying that she and her sister were in the process of trying to digitize the entire archive. The pictures are interesting, but not particularly useful. Except one. She called it up in her email and turned her screen so he could see. 11 girls stood on the lawn in front of Idlewild, each girl holding a field hockey stick. They wore field hockey uniforms, and they were carefully posed, the girls on each side angled inward, their shoulders overlapping. Despite the sports uniforms, they all looked formal, unsmiling white girls of varying shapes and sizes staring into the lens, waiting for the picture to be taken. At the left end was a woman who was obviously a teacher, though she looked to be only in her early 20s. Neat handwriting across the top stated, "Idlewild Girls Field Hockey Team, 1952, 2 years after Sonia's death." Fiona let Jamie look at the photo, and then she clicked to the next attachment. It was a scan of the back of the photo, which was covered in the same neat handwriting, the ink only slightly faded over time. Jamie leaned forward. "Shit," he said. "This is a list of their names." "It's the only photo with handwriting," Fiona said. She clicked back to the photo itself and pointed to the pixels of black and white, the blur of the girls' faces. "One of these girls must have known Sonia. And if we dig, somebody must still be alive." It was nearly 1 o'clock when they found her. The beer was long gone, and Fiona's eyes hurt, moving dryly in her skull as if they were made from the cracked volcanic ash of Pompeii. She was no stranger to internet searches. She was something of an expert at them, in fact. A journalist had to be in this day and age. But she was soft, she realized. She'd spent too much time looking up gluten-free brownie recipes and ways to use egg cups to make Christmas decorations, and she'd never tried to find this many people from so long ago. Most of the girls in the photograph, as far as they could tell, were dead. 4 of the 11, frustratingly, had such common names that it was impossible to pin down who they might be. Since few Idlewild girls were local, they could have been born anywhere, so records searches were no good. One girl, Roberta Green, a tall, pretty girl with a braid of pale hair, had possibly become a lawyer in New Hampshire under a married name. That was interesting, and Fiona wondered how an Idlewild girl had ended up with an expensive law school education. But it was Jamie who hit the jackpot, and he hit it with the teacher.
"Sarah London," he said. "Never married. Retired teacher. Member of the East Mills Ladies Society."
He turned his laptop toward her, showing her the society's webpage, complete with photo, and gave a tired smile that even this late, even with her ashy eyes, made Fiona's stomach flutter.
"Thank God for old spinsters," he said. "I'll get an address from the DMV tomorrow."
It was a lucky break. They went to bed at last, and even though they were both exhausted, they pulled each other's clothes off in silence. Fiona didn't need any words as she slid her fingers through his hair, as he kissed the tender skin along her jawline and just below her ear, as he flexed his arms around her and pulled her in tight, as she hooked her legs over the backs of his thighs and smelled the scent of his skin and let all her thoughts spiral away as sensation took over. After, Jamie dressed and curled up against her back in his t-shirt and boxers, asleep before his head hit the pillow. Fiona lay on her side with her knees up, her eyes open, feeling the weight of his arm over her waist and the deep, soothing rhythm of his breathing, and as she did so often, she thought about Deb. Fiona had been at Tim Christopher's murder trial, sitting in the front seats reserved for the victim's family. She'd thought she'd get an argument when she said she wanted to go. But by the time of the trial, it felt like her parents had been snatched by aliens that inhabited their bodies, leaving them silent and apathetic, barely able to look her in the eye. Maybe a 17-year-old girl shouldn't have been there, but it didn't matter. She'd gone. The trial, she realized later, had been her full initiation into adult life, even more than the murder had been. afterward, she'd no longer been able to pretend that this was happening to someone else, or that Deb had just died naturally and peacefully in her sleep. Both fantasies she'd used while lying in bed at night, wishing for